Hello and welcome to The Leap of Faith. Well, just as our panel last week were reviewing the protection of minors in the church summit at the Vatican, we were yet to become aware of the story unfolding in Australia. The trial of Cardinal George Pell was underway, covered by an order of secrecy, which was only lifted with the conviction of the third most powerful man in the Catholic Church hierarchy. The announcement on Tuesday of Pell's conviction in December came after a media gag order was lifted by Australian prosecutors who dropped separate sexual assault charges against Cardinal Pell. To discuss this further, we're joined from Australia by Ben Matthews. Ben is professor in the School of Law at the Queensland University of Technology in Brisbane. He's worked extensively in the field of child protection and he contributed to the Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Sexual Abuse, which was established by the Australian government. Also with me in the studio is RT's religious and social affairs correspondent, Joe Little. Gentlemen, welcome. Well, first of all, Ben, we're speaking this evening about the conviction of Cardinal Pell, most particularly. But please tell us, if you would, very briefly, what your work with the Royal Commission involved.
Okay, so first I was retained by the Royal Commission to conduct several research projects for it. One of which was about the history of mandatory reporting legislation in Australia. Another was about how to conduct a prevalence study of child sexual abuse and child maltreatment more generally. And another was about oversight mechanisms for child and youth serving organisations to help prevent child sexual abuse and make sure that appropriate responses happen once it has happened within an organisation. And I was also a professorial fellow to the Commission more generally.
Now, you must have been watching the case of Cardinal Pell very closely. Define the significance of this conviction for us.
Look, it is extremely significant. It is a bombshell globally. He is the most senior member of the Catholic Church to have been convicted as an individual of committing child sexual offences, and these offences are serious offences. He's been convicted of five offences committed at separate times. One count is of sexual penetration of a child aged under 16, so the complainant was 13 at the time and it was forced oral sex. There are four other counts of indecent acts with or in the presence of a child under 16. He's almost certain to be imprisoned for a substantial period of time. These are incredibly significant developments for the global Catholic Church.
Now, we're led to believe that an appeal will be put in place. How successful might that be?
That's a good question, and any answer to that is slightly speculative. My own view is that if we look at other kinds of appeals in sexual abuse or sexual assault cases, then there does not seem on its face to be any substantial miscarriage of justice here. There are three grounds of appeal. One of which is that the verdict was unsafe or unsatisfactory, basically alleging that there simply was not sufficient evidence to sustain a conviction. There are two other grounds of appeal that are being argued, and one is that the defence was not permitted to play a video that it had created which claimed to depict the location of people in the church at the time. And a third ground of appeal is that the jury, that there were problems with the constitution of the jury. So I think the defence is at the point where it's basically trying every argument it can and hoping for the best.
Now, we also have the unusual situation of Pell's lawyer, Robert Richter, issuing an apology yesterday. What happened there?
I did briefly see that he had apologised for a comment he made in the pre-hearing about sentence. So as a matter of technical legal procedure, defence counsel make submissions to the court about the extent of seriousness of the offending. And so what Robert Richter would have done in representing his client was to attempt to depict that this kind of offending on the spectrum of offending is less serious than some other kinds of offending for the same count. Now, his apology concerns the language he used to do that. So he described the oral rape offence as nothing more than a plain, ordinary kind of garden variety, vanilla kind of offending in that context, to try and distinguish it from even more egregious kind of circumstances. Now, I think what he has done is he's realised, given the public outcry, that his language to describe that was inflammatory and insensitive in the public perception. And it's relevant that the public just generally don't know the kinds of technical legal arguments that happen in these pre-sentence hearings. In any event, defence counsel could have made that exact same argument without using those insensitive terms, and that's the key point here. So I think he has belatedly understood the insensitivity of that terminology, and he's apologised for it.
Professor Ben Matthews, stay with us if you would, but also with me is RT's religious and social affairs correspondent Joe Little. Joe, how do you place this conviction in terms of its impact here in Ireland, here at home?
Well, I think Irish people are more familiar with Australia than with most English-speaking countries abroad, perhaps with the exception of the United States. And I think there is, certainly within the church, an awareness, for instance, of the role of Cardinal Mannix as an anti-establishment figure. At the time of the Irish War of Independence, he had opposed conscription in Australia and had been a huge support to the Irish national movement here. So there is a kind of an honorary Irishman, honorary patriot accolade that would have fallen on Mannix's shoulders. So there would be a generally favourable attitude among, say, families whose young men may have gone through All Hallows Seminary in Dublin in preparation for ministering in English language countries, and many of them would have gone to Australia, many nuns as well, and of course many Irish emigrants are there still. But that said, I think the impact of the Royal Commission's proceedings over the last number of years has been quite great here in Ireland, because the Royal Commission in Australia was, apart from the Boston scandal involving cardinal law, was the event which in a way reassured those who were outraged and appalled and apologetic about, some of them very, very apologetic, of course, in the church about the clerical child sexual abuse scandals that have been in the public eye here for over 2.5 decades. This placed them in a wider context, that this was a systemic problem in Australian institutions, and particularly in the Catholic Church in Australia, and particularly in boys' and girls' homes where children who couldn't be parented, in neighbourhoods and cities and on the farms, you know, ended up getting a very raw deal indeed, and that sexual abuse was part of it. So there was a lot of resonance with, say, the findings of the Ryan report on institutionalised abuse, with the Murphy report here, both judicial-led reports, the Murphy report on the Dublin Archdiocese and on the Cloyne Diocese. And I think that hearing this about, first of all, the conviction and then the acquittal of Archbishop Brian Wilson of Adelaide last year on the charge of covering up abuse, and now hearing about the conviction of Cardinal Pell, who of course was elevated to be part of the C9, the Pope's kitchen cabinet, really does bring it home to Irish people that these scandals are a long time festering and take a long time to actually be pursued and brought out into the open.
Well, Joe, you talked about concealment there, and it's a completely different set of circumstances, and there's no accusations or charges of any kind. But some senior figures in the Catholic Church here in Ireland have effectively, if inadvertently, covered up attempts to investigate abuse by their loyalty to canon law. I'm thinking, you know, for example, the situation with Cardinal Brady.
Yeah, it's 25 years since Ulster Television's Suffer Little Children documentary was produced. Chris Moore, an investigative journalist, found that the Norbertine priest, Father Brendan Smith, who lived in a monastery just south of the border, had been wending his way back and forth across the border and insinuating his way into households, into families, and abusing survivors. Just in parentheses, the first survivor of clerical sexual abuse I met, well, she was a victim of it. Her daughter had been abused. But this mother told me that the first thing she did when she was told some 3 decades ago that Smith had abused her daughter is she wrote to him and she said she was praying for his vocation. And that, in a sense, locates where people's trust in priests
in a timeline, you actually need to do that, don't you, if you're looking back 25 years?
You do. Yeah. And it emerged in Moore's investigation that a fellow Norbertine, Father Bruno Mulvihill, had tried to bring to the attention of his ecclesiastical betters that the that this was going on. And they froze him out and made life very difficult for him. So Father Sean Brady had been tasked with helping to conduct a canonical tribunal involving two teenage boys who'd been abused by Smith. And he, as a canon lawyer and then secretary of the diocese, swore those two boys to secrecy about the testimony they gave to another cleric at that court. And that surfaced later on. And Cardinal Brady was severely criticised for having that on his record. At this stage, he'd been brought back to Ireland just after the Chris Moore investigation and moved from the prestigious position of head of the Irish College in Rome, where he'd been for 16 years, into the parish of Ballyhays in County Cavan as an anonymous parish priest. And it was clear that although he had many other qualities, that one of the principal reasons he was being brought to Ireland was to deal with what was hurtling down the tracks in the Smith scandal. And he was soon made Archbishop in waiting of Armagh, and a year later the Primate of All Ireland, and he was handling, among other things, the Smith scandal.
And yet you quoted that in Australia that there was a charge taken for concealment. Are there any consequences going to appear in Ireland for a similar situation?
Well, the consequence has already occurred in the case of the other cardinal who got the red hat during the scandal, the denouement of these scandals, and that was Cardinal Desmond Connell of Dublin. And only, I think, a handful of public figures attended his funeral, which was unheard of in Nationalist Ireland, that so few public figures would go to his funeral. And the main reason so few went to his funeral was that he had to be dragged kicking and screaming by prominent survivors of abuse in his diocese, most notably Mary Collins, who was appointed by Pope Francis for a while to his Pontifical Council on Child Protection, kicking and screaming into setting up a system for responding to survivors of abuse. And Des Connell was on the brink of suing his successor, Archbishop Dermot Martin, to prevent him from handing over some 5,000 documents to the aforementioned Murphy Commission of Investigation into the Diocese, because he believed that the bond between bishop and priest was the most sacred bond of father and son and could not be in any way traduced in a civil court.
And as you say, you were setting up the idea of a timeline which was, you know, over a 25-year period. Just let's go back to Australia for a moment to Professor Ben Matthews. Ben, given the Australian legal system appears to have been fairly proactive in this case, what about other jurisdictions? Are there any ticking time bombs waiting to go off elsewhere?
Look, I think there are. And I think for the Vatican, this is a bit of a numbers game. So it can sustain substantial losses and hits to its reputation in countries like Australia and Ireland, and it may not be enough. Even there, even given the scale of the scandals and the scale of the offending and the cover-ups in these two countries and in others, even the US, even those events may not be enough, as we've seen, to force structural change to canon law, which is what is really required here. We have so many other countries around the world, in Africa, in Southeast Asia, in South America, with vast populations of Catholics. We have Brazil, Mexico, and the Philippines alone, where combined there's 360 million population of Catholics. In Australia, we've got 25 million people here. About a fifth of those are Catholics, and not all of those are practicing. Ireland, you've got maybe 4 million. So in terms of the universal spread and influence and power and economic base of the Vatican, these countries, Ireland, Australia, even the US, are small compared with the broader global setting. Nevertheless, I think what's really important is that in these other countries, We have not yet witnessed the scale of offending and the scale of cover-ups and the senior figures involved to the extent that we have in, say, Ireland and the States and Australia. Sure, we're starting to see it now in places like Chile and Argentina, but I think there really is a time bomb waiting to go off in many of these countries where people will become emboldened to make disclosures of what experiences they've suffered, and people will mobilise and demand change. Now, that's going to be difficult in some senses. It'll be difficult in bringing criminal complaints in societies where there may be, you know, particular problems with corruption and governance and the rule of law. But nevertheless, I think it is a time bomb waiting to go off, and the mobilisation of the laity may well be a force that cannot be stopped in due course.
Ben, one of our participants on last week's programme was Professor Donald Palmer, and he was talking really about how organisations and the culture of organisations can contribute to this particular situation. You've experience of organisations other than the church as well.
I have. And so I've considered other child and youth serving organisations and the kinds of systems that they either do or do not possess to prevent, identify and respond appropriately to child sexual abuse. And what that has disclosed many things, but one of the things it has disclosed, and I'm sorry to come back to the Catholic Church here, but I think we have to, really, as scientists and as people with a social conscience, is that the Roman Catholic Church is unique. It's qualitatively unique in its nature. It's unique in the extent of its offending and of the cover-ups, and it's unique in its culture and governance frameworks. It is exquisitely set up for the infliction and cover-up of child sexual abuse on an industrial scale. And that is largely to do with its culture, which requires complete obedience to your superiors to protect your standing and career, and in which dissent is silenced. There is a massive dominance of internal rules, and this is, I think, the key problem for the Catholic Church. Canon law is seen as superior to civil law, and that is what everyone within the Church must conform with. And the key requirement of canon law that is relevant to this whole context is that secrecy is required. Secrecy is the paramount obligation of every individual concerned with any case of child sexual abuse to avoid scandal in the community and to avoid damage to the church's reputation. As long as this requirement of secrecy is there, nothing will change at a fundamental level. The changes will be superficial and piecemeal. So canon law and the procedural rules and provisions in the 1962 Crimen Solicitationis document must be amended, or we will forever be fighting this problem.
Joe Little, is that likely?
Well, I tend to see the bottle a little bit fuller, maybe, because I've come across some remarkable people who have signalled that this is coming down the tracks. For instance, Father Kevin Hegarty, for a long time, a curate out on the most western reaches of County Mayo, next parish to Boston. Kevin Hegarty, as a young priest, was editor of the Clergy's Magazine, which was published from Maynooth, under the gaze of Bishop Brendan Comiskey of ill repute in the quest on the question of covering up abuse of children, as it emerged subsequently. And when Kevin got a former priest who was a social worker, this is in the early to mid 1990s, to write an article about the dangers posed to the church of clerical child sexual abuse, given his having served as a priest, this specialist also, as I say, was working in the social services. When that article was published, although it contained no detail, Kevin Hegarty lost his job. And similarly, Bishop Geoffrey Robinson, who was an auxiliary bishop in Sydney, who Ben may have come across, Bishop Robinson spoke to me on the This Week programme many years ago, over 10 years ago, about his efforts as a survivor of abuse himself to chair the Australian Catholic Bishops Committee on Child Protection. And he threw up his hands and stepped down because he said that the Vatican was not doing enough to respond to survivors' needs. And in Ireland, one bishop of all the auxiliaries and all the bishops who served in Dublin in the era, the generation of abuse studied by the Judge Yvonne Murphy's commission, just one bishop, Bishop Jim Moriarty, stepped down because he felt he was complicit. So there are people in that, as Ben describes it, that organisation which demands absolute obedience from its clerics and from its consecrated nuns and brothers. There are a few people who prophetically stood out and said the kinds of things which Cardinal Supich was saying in the Vatican last week, one of the organisers. He talked about the truth setting the church free. Well, that's what Geoffrey Robinson said. He wrote a book, Confronting Power and Sex in the Catholic Church. And he was in despair at the Catholic Church's shutting out of the needs of survivors. Mm.
Joe, I suppose this also sets us up to the next topic, which is being covered by RT News at the moment, which is the Scouting Ireland camp, which is supposedly taking place this weekend. And does that set a precedent for us to see the difference between how maybe one organisation and another will approach this topic?
The difficulty with Scouting Ireland, first of all, it has been established that some 300 survivors of abuse have made their complaints known about historical abuse, which of course is still wreaking havoc in the lives of the people who were abused. To call it historical is simply to say that it was happening under the watch of people who are by and large dead now. But what has emerged this week is that there are grave concerns in the social services, in the Statutory Child Protection Agency, TUSLA, about the short form reports it's been getting from Scouting Ireland, which has its child protection mechanism overseen by Ian Elliott, who has been the Catholic Church appointed auditor of child protection procedures in the Catholic Church over about 15 years, since stepped down, very frustrated with the Catholic Church's record on this. But Ian Elliott is a consultant and for almost 2 years has been engaged by a newly structured Scouting Ireland organisation, which has been trying to come to terms with its historical baggage, but now finds itself accused of, for instance, conducting in-depth interviews with a girl who complained that she had been abused. It's a mixed-sex organisation. And three interviews, whereas the legislation says that only the police and the statutory social services should interview and assess complaints. In other words, the role of the organisation which the abuse is alleged to have taken place is simply to record and pass on through defined channels to the statutory authorities a complaint. But these kinds of examples of failures to comply with the very new child protection legislation in this country are certainly creating waves. And scouting is an extremely popular pursuit here. I hear that it's difficult to get a child into a scout troop at the moment in Ireland. But it is certainly creating a lot of waves about whether or not child protection is adequate in scouting. And it may actually call into question the efforts to bring child protection laws into force on the ground in organisations, because people may say, well, if scouting seems okay at the moment, so, I mean, why all the fuss? So there's going to be an element of denial about the reason d'être for having these new laws.
Ben Matthews, I'm almost hearing the idea, and I'd be interested in your perspective on this, is that this isn't something that can be left to an organisation itself or even to a police force. Is there a need for a bigger organisation, bigger than a church, bigger than any organisation, to moderate and control this?
That's a good question. I think what you're talking about there is what is the best mechanism to design and implement changes and reforms to make child and youth serving organisations safe for kids and to minimise the likelihood that sexual abuse will happen there. I think there is a good argument for some external oversight. And I think there are some really good, positive, good news stories in this respect. So Australia, for example, has witnessed some significant changes in recent years, influenced by the Royal Commission, and the USA has, and other countries have as well. One of the things that's happened in Australia is the embedding in legislation in some jurisdictions of what are called child safe standards for child and youth serving organisations. And these child safe standards must be complied with by all relevant organisations that provide services to children, whether it's education, religion, sport, cultural and arts and recreational activities. And so the kinds of things that they're required to do and to report on and to be accountable for to an external oversight body are things like having a sound code of conduct, a detailed code of conduct, proper hiring and screening practices, an educational program for its staff, obligations to report known and suspected cases, an organisational commitment in policy to prevention of child sexual abuse. And I think given the scale of child and youth serving organisations and the sheer number of kids it serves, I think these are really positive developments, and they can be done in quite efficient and cost-effective ways.
Professor Ben Matthews in Australia this evening, and Joe Little here in the studio with me. Thank you for joining us. And that's our programme for this week from all of us here tonight. Producer Sheila O'Callaghan, and from me, Michael Cummin. Good night.